Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning painter Tracy Ziegler. Ziegler trained at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. Her beautiful and haunting landscape paintings have appeared in both solo and group exhibitions all over the U.S. and Canada, including Gallery 71 in New York, the Chase Gallery in Boston, and the Odin Wagner Gallery in Toronto, as well as the Herbert F. Johnson Museum here at Cornell University. She has received many grants and awards, including the New York Partnership Painting Fellowship in 2008. And while thinking about and researching alternative places to show her work, she began a very unique project, and her paintings are now being exhibited in several maximum security prisons. Welcome to the show, Tracy.
Thank you.
Now, were you introduced to art as a child? Tell us about your beginnings.
My sister, who is older than I, is an artist, and so I was always in the shadow of her doing artwork. And in fact, when I was first young, I was not really allowed to do any artwork.
Literally allowed?
No. I mean, I went to art class with her because, you know, that was a place to stick me as I was growing up, but she was the artist in the family, and our family was kind of like the family who played Monopoly, and she got the blue thing, and I had to come up with another thing, and that was the extent of it. And we've talked about that because she says, that can't be right. You can't have not been able to. And then my other sister verified, and she says, yeah, I wasn't allowed to do art either, you know, because it was like her special domain.
Mm-hmm. So when did you finally break out and say, I am going to do this?
After I went to social work school, and I was in social work school, and I was a social worker, and then I remember saying, I think I want to go to art school. Of course, my father was extremely exasperated. It was like, when are you going to settle down and do, you know, da-da-da? And, you know, then I went to art. I mean, I have always had done work. Mm-hmm. I've always drawn. I've always done crafts. I mm-hmm. have always, and my family has always been, you know, if they weren't artists, they were, like, involved in working with their hands. And
mm-hmm. So
and,
craftspeople.
Yeah, uh-huh. So that was always a, you know, a viable way of doing
uh-huh.
things.
And But you knew that you wanted to do it seriously. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I had to make the abrupt change. I could not, like, be a social worker and then go to art school mm-hmm. and be that Sunday painter. I had mm-hmm. to totally give up social work, and I became a janitor. And so when I met with my professional friends, and they said, well, what are you doing these days? And I'm like, I'm a janitor.
And you did that to put yourself through art school?
Yeah. Well, at that point, I had gone to University of Pennsylvania, and I maxed out on everything that anybody would give me in terms of financial aid. So when I went to the academy, they had to give me a scholarship, you know, the kind where you don't have to pay it back or anything like
uh-huh.
that, you know. So,
uh-huh.
but then I survived it.
What a great trail that you went on. Now your paintings have been described as haunting, dreamlike, and one notices that they're quite dark, and there are flashes of light in them. To tell us about that metamorphosis of your work.
Well, it's part of it is kind of how I see things. I mean, I see shadows before I see the actual. I mean, I had a discussion with Odin one time when I went to painting because I was doing monoprints, and then I changed my medium to painting, and he objected to the fact that my shadows were so intense, and, you know, what I could get away in the printmaking medium, he didn't think I could get away in the painting medium, because you can sort of, like, do things and sort of, like, punctuate something in a graphic way, and you can make a sky, you can, you know, throw down a couple colors and say, I call that a sky.
Mm-hmm.
And in the graphic medium, the rest of the world say, okay, I call it a sky too. You know, we'll suspend belief.
So it's more of an impressionistic
availability
for you. Uh-huh.
But when I went to painting, he was like, well, you can't do it. And I'm like, well, and I didn't want to be too defensive with him, but I wanted to say that when I see something, when I see a house, I actually see the shadow of the house before I see a house.
It's almost like a ghost image?
It's whatever it is about that house, that shadow that gets cast across the lawn, is what interests me. And it's not the house, it is the shadow. Or if I see a reflection in the water, I see the reflection in the water before I see the house. It's that reflection that interests me. And so I know, like Plato says, we don't understand the world, but I understand the world more through the shadows and the reflection.
And that shows up in your art.
Yeah.
Beautiful paintings.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're living in the shadows. Now, one thing that one does notice looking at your body of work, that there are never any people inhabiting your landscapes. Why is this?
There's a specificity. What is the word I want to use?
Specificity?
Yes, a word that would describe a situation that I'm not really interested in. I'm more interested in, I think when I wrote to you about seeing the foundations in my neighborhood. You know, I live in the woods, and you walk into the woods and you see these foundations of buildings. And I never, ever think, who lived there? What did they do here? How did they get here? I'm just so focused on the visual remains of that. And that's how it is for me. If I see like a house that I want to like paint, and often I see things out of the corner of my eye when I'm going down the highway, it's something immediate about the visual language that happens about whether it's the light being cast out of the house. And I think, well, do I really want to meet that person who lives in there? And I'm like, no, I don't. I really don't. Because they'd probably be boring and, you know.
But would you call the houses remains? But they have been inhabited, and they probably are still.
They are remains. I love that sense. I love the legacy of something that's been passed along. And the houses I love, obviously, are the ones that have this intense patina. You know, I see this fallen down house. I'm like, oh, I love that house. You know,
well, you know, I notice in your paintings that you can't tell if something has been abandoned or if somebody has left these houses behind. Then that's what makes them so haunting.
That's what I don't want to give the time away. I don't want to give away whether you're too late for whatever's happening or you're too early. It's just that moment. And I guess some people work through their life through time. I'm really into time in some respect, but in my paintings, I like the sense I don't want any. And that's why I always, they're never in the middle of the day, because I would like, oh my God, it's the middle of the day, big deal. You know, it's always either in the beginning of the day or in the evening, where it's sort of this ambiguous light. Of course, the light is really beautiful at that time, and when you look at the sky during noon, someone is going to argue with me. To me, it's a flat blue, if mm-hmm. it's a blue sky, just flat. Yeah. But in the morning or at the end of the day, you have that darkness coming on, so you have this glow. And if it was a bright day, you have this intense glow that happens right around, mm-hmm. you know, the sun sort of hitting.
And things can be hidden.
Mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm,
some of those mm-hmm. those lights between midday, which reveals too much, it sounds like, to you.
Yeah, I don't want to know that much. You know, just give me part of the story.
Now, how do you find your subjects? Do you just wander around and look for them, or how do you do that?
I think a lot of the times I'm just going down the highway driving. You know, in Ithaca, you know, you spend a lot of time in the car, and so things happen to you or happen in your peripheral vision. Of course, now mine is kind of not so good, but I don't know. Things that you see out of the corner of your eye.
And do you go back and photograph them? How do you actually?
No, I had a very dogmatic conversation with somebody about photographs, and I'm like, oh man, you're so dogmatic, you know. And I don't want to be dogmatic, but I don't believe in photographs.
So you actually set up your easel from memory?
I do fairly intense black and white drawings, and I won't do photographs anywhere, because I really think that. I need to experience that I'm seeing, not only visually, but in all your senses, you know, this discomfort of being there. I mean, it's very uncomfortable to go out and do a drawing somewhere. You know, you have people telling you, you know, keep
looking
working
over your
at
shoulder.
It. You're going to
uh-huh.
get better eventually. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they want to tell you about their cousin is a great, you know, whatever. Do you know her? She draws really well, you know, whatever. So there's all this amount of discomfort, which I think adds. So I like drawing, you know, at the place. And then using, and I do fairly academic drawings, so I wouldn't want those drawings to be representative of what I do, because they're almost too academic. Mm. But for me, it just starts a dialogue. And it's also when I travel, too, I've learned not to take photographs when I travel, because you set up this reciprocity with where you are. So actually, I do like those people that come up and say something to me, because I feel, unlike a photograph, I'd be taking a photograph and that'd be end of the story. I go out of there and that's it. But when I sit there and draw, everybody has a comment to make. And it does become part of the experience.
Part of the story.
And you're giving back, you know, you're exposing yourself. And it's very different than when you're taking a photograph. I mean, I went through Italy and had tons of conversations, and people have no problem just grabbing your sketchbook out of your hand and looking at him. I'm like, do people do this with journals? If I was writing in my journal, would they grab my... But it's almost something about drawing lets you be an open book.
Yeah, people think it's a public thing.
When you're doing it. I mean, I like that.
When you're doing it publicly, they think it's public,
right?
Now, do you always work in oil? Because a lot of your paintings look like watercolor to me. You must use oil in a specific way.
I use, because I started out as a painter in art school, and I did 2 years as a painter. And there are just so many rules about painting at the academy. And I'm at another school, there might have been less rules. But, you know, there's just too many rules. You weren't allowed to do this. And I had.
But is that them just trying to teach you a basis as being a painter, and then you
thing.
Can go off and...
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But after 2 years of that, I decided that I wanted to go into the printmaking department, which has their own set of rules, but it felt more fluid to what I wanted to do. I had one painting instructor who said, I just committed the worst sin in the entire world. And I'm like, I wonder, you know, what could be the worst sin you could possibly do in the world?
As a painter.
Well, I'm not married. I don't have kids. I didn't murder my kids. What did I do? What did I do? And, you know, I modeled the nude in violet.
Oh.
And that, if you want to know, is the worst sin in the entire world. That is the worst it.
No kidding.
So, yeah.
One does need to get out of those kinds of places.
And so I went to the printmaking department, and there could have been rules there, but I was totally oblivious, and nobody was timing, you know, and you sort of make your way.
So do you use...
Oh, that was the question.
Use oils in a different manner,
oil.
Though?
I do use... And the point of my answer is that I developed a style of painting that I borrowed from printmaking.
Ah.
And part of it is laying down color. I mean, with printmaking, when you printmake with color, each color traditionally is a different plate.
Mm-hmm.
And you lay color upon color upon color. And so I use that approach to use color, you know, just laying one color down and slowly building up the density of color. But I also borrowed from painting the idea of a grisaille, which is a black and white and gray painting that is painted underneath the painting.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Titian's did it. El Greco did it. And they did it where they took... Titian probably did it better than El Greco. El Greco takes his black and white... And I think El Greco is great. I love him. But he took his black and white paintings and then he did washes over top of them.
Mm.
And I actually took that approach and reversed it, what the traditional grisaille is, and so that I do a instead of washes over the dark areas, I do washes over the light areas and do opacity over the dark areas.
I think that's great when people go back to traditions and use them in the modern era that has become quite high tech and probably not as pure.
No, not as pure at all. And I also make my own paints too, which gives it a viscosity.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the painter Tracy Ziegler, and we're talking about her work. Now, you began to exhibit your work in non-traditional places like doctor's offices, and you discovered that the reactions you were getting were different than you would if they were being exhibited in galleries. To talk to us about that, it seems to have changed your approach.
Well, I think one of the things, though, in exhibiting, well, I exhibited at, you know, the cardiologist's office, Lynn Swisher's office, and I was getting responses from people that they were really nervous about going to the doctors. It's not like just going in for a cold, you're going in for your heart. And that there was a certain amount of recognition, comfort, whatever it was happening.
Mm-hmm. You said comfort. People
comfort,
were, experiencing comfort.
I mean, I don't like to think that, oh, here's my painting and, you know, I hope it makes you feel comfortable or anything. But there was something happening and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder what happens if you put things into, and of course now you know that I'm working with space. So space becomes so defining how I see life and how I see people as being defined by. And so it's like putting a, my box within this other box.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, what happens when you address the space that you're putting it in, kind of similar to how you're dealing with the painting itself? It becomes sort of, I hate to use the word ontological, but it defines the person who's in that space. That space that, you know, when you're in a doctor's office, no matter who you are, you're the, you know, you're the patient. You know, so you become identified by that space. Mm-hmm. And so I started trying to think about, well, a couple different things. You know, that whole idea of how you get defined by the space that you're in and how the meaning of art changes when you put it in different spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens when...
Which leads you to the current project you're working on. You're putting your paintings in prisons.
Well, I was trying to think of the most intense situation that defined a person according to the space he was in. And even though the hospital defines you as a patient for the time you're there, when you leave, thank God you're no longer the patient. You know, where prison, you're defined by that space there, and you will continue to be defined by that space.
Probably for years.
Forever.
Most
yeah,
of them.
Yeah.
Many
I mean,
of them
always,
forever.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to know, how does my space fit into that space? Does it get annihilated by the prison, or does it create another space within that space?
And so you're exhibiting in several, you know, prisons. And mm-hmm. what are you finding out? How are the paintings affecting the prisoners?
You know, I just started this a couple months ago, so I haven't got a lot of feedback. I put out a questionnaire for the inmates, and I don't want to go in and think of it as art therapy. I didn't want to think of it as educational. I wanted to present the exhibition in the same way that I would exhibit an exhibit at a gallery,
mm-hmm.
where I have no intention of doing therapy with the people who come into the gallery, and
that's
I have
no
intention of doing educational. And so I wanted that kind of approach, and so I didn't really want to have sort of a psychological understanding of how they were viewing the work. I just wanted them to have a sense of experiencing the painting and experiencing the space that they're in. So I put out a questionnaire for the inmates about just sort of like, if they haven't had the experience of seeing a lot of art, what are some of the ways you can look at art? You know, do you see distance? Do you see things close up? You know, is there a time of day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just sort of just things you can think about looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And
I bet it brings up a lot of memories.
I think that one of the things that I think that people, when they look at my work, is that there have been three different ways that people look at the work. It reminds them of a place that they've been, or it reminds them of a place, or makes them think of a place that they want to go to, or a place that they're in. So it has these three dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know that that was real. I spent an afternoon with some inmates in Ohio, and I just brought 35 paintings. And it was amazing. One of the amazing things, the first inmate that I met was this person who got an MFA from one of the schools that I went to. So it was like old home week, you know.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And so his standard of understanding art, obviously, was sophisticated. He created this fairly sophisticated group of inmates around art. And so basically we spent the afternoon just talking about art.
Well, it takes me back to your original thought that I think art can be therapeutic and educational. I know it's not the intention when you're producing.
Well, the reason I go against that is someone asked me, is art therapeutic? And I said, well, it's therapeutic if you think that breathing is therapeutic. It's so much more integrated
mm-hmm.
into who we are. And so I don't think breathing is therapeutic. So it just
if you don't breathe, you're going to need some
yeah,
therapy,
right,
though.
Right. But I also don't think that art is the workhorse of therapy. I don't think art should be the workhorse of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should be the workhorse of education. It's an experience so totally in itself. I mean, people understand art in different ways because it's a hard thing to understand. I mean, people grasp different aspects of art in order to understand it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, art can go back to culture. It
mm-hmm,
can go back.
Mm-hmm.
It can go back to people's mm-hmm. childhoods.
yeah,
and emotions.
Yeah. I also think, you know, now we're on this thing of art as therapy, and I'm not against art therapy in any way, but I think that I like to think of art not as a self-expression, that as self-expression, it's kind of like a, it, to me, it seems static. Mm. I like to think of it more as a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And you like to think of it as fluid, perhaps.
And fluid. And mm-hmm. so, therefore, you know, I told the inmates, you know, I said, I don't care about your psychology. You don't care that I had the meanest mom this side of the Mississippi, you know? You just don't care about that. And, you know, if I had anything like that in my artwork, you know, my stuff, you know, is not about my psychological feelings.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of artists do paint political paintings. Picasso did.
In regard to what was happening historically at those moments. Cool. It's just not my, you know, yeah. how I see it.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I understand that. Now, you said that you thought prisoners' memories were their largest dimension of space, but a warden told you that memory of space is the first dimension that inmates lose.
That blew me away.
That blows me away. That's why I wanted to bring it up.
I was like, oh, my God.
Does that mean their world shrinks?
Yeah. Well, if you think about if you ever lost someone you love mm-hmm. and you just want to hold on to that memory of that face, you know, and as time goes by, you lose that dimension,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know, my father was killed and, you know, it's very hard.
So painting can open up space then, is what he was telling you perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's what he thought.
Uh-huh.
I thought that's why he was welcoming me into his prison. And he gave me the full extent of his prison too.
I think it's amazing. I still think art can change people's lives, and I know you sound like you don't want to attribute anything so big to that, but art has changed my life in many ways.
Well, that was one of my questions. You know, I remember talking somewhere. I'm like, well, you know, if you were given a death sentence, would you want to look at art? And I went to, and not to put down anybody in Soho, or not Soho, Chelsea, but I saw the show, and it was a towel hanging on the wall. And I'm not trying to sound like a Philistine. You know, I'm sure there's good art of towels on walls, but I'm like, if someone was on death row, and they were given a piece of art to look, is this the image they want?
Mm.
You know, and then I think about that. If you had one, you know, if you're dealing with those really pivotal existential moments, you know, like you're having a heart attack, you probably don't want to look at art at that point. But, you know, in case you wanted to, what kind of art would you want to look at?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I imagine there would be different answers from every different person that you would talk to.
Yeah, right. It's not a... Mm-hmm. And a different answer for a different situation. You know, it just moves.
Yeah. Now, I've noticed that your paintings have great titles. How do you come up with... Do you come up with the titles before you... The horizon is a distant memory. When the sea reaches my grandmother's house. They're very poetic.
You know, I always have titles afterwards. Title before, it's like having the thought of what you're doing. I don't think you can ever, or I can't, have a clear idea of where I'm going because I don't want to illustrate a thought,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to illustrate a title. So I just sort of follow it along, and then I like my grandmother.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you don't want people in your paintings, but you have the names of people in your titles in some ways.
Right, because they are very personal. Even though I have no people in the paintings, they're very personal.
They are. They're very intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Your paintings are very intimate. They're revealing more than you probably want to reveal.
Yeah. Like, I had one note for an art show one time. It was the one of the bird. I had a house sitter who said, after she took care of my birds for a couple of weeks, she learned more about me from my parents than I will ever know.
Now, you're simultaneously doing the prison exhibit, and you want to do a gallery exhibit, and it's going to be called A Memory of Space.
Mm-hmm.
So this is exactly what we're going back to. That's what your paintings reveal to us. It's mm-hmm. a memory of space.
A memory of space. Someone said this about it, and I thought, oh, that's a cool thing. He thought it was the experience of existing in space without the words.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh, well, if I could do that, that's really cool. I like that one. Thank you. I like that. And also, one of the inmates looked at one, and he totally identified with this trailer and said, that's where I really belong. I don't really belong in this prison. I belong in that trailer. And I like that idea, too, that it's a projection of something in the future.
Well, what has art done for you in your life? Are you glad that you segued from being a social worker to being an artist?
I am. My time is my own. My space is my own. When I was a social worker, when I started being a social worker, I was a social worker at the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic, and it was a very creative place. It was all about the phenomenology of social work. And so it was a very here and now provocative way of it. And that would have been okay. But in the real world, that's often not the approach that agencies take. And I could not have survived in a traditional psychoanalytic way of approaching problems.
Are you an artist who worries about selling paintings? Is that upmost on your mind? Would you feel like a failure if you didn't sell your art? Or are you doing it because you have to do it, you know?
You do artwork because you have to do it. It's not really a decision. My husband is an artist, and he studied with this person, and, you know, that's what Myron always said was, you don't make a decision about art. You do it because you have to.
But you don't worry about selling constantly?
You know, no. Well, I've done it for 20 years now. I've had a show every year for 20 years, or a couple shows a year, and after a while you think, well, it's not really about selling, you know, it's not. And it never was. I mean, when I was in college and I was a janitor, you know, that was going to be my life. I was going to be a janitor, and I mean, I don't know if I want to be a janitor at my age now. I probably would have said, it's getting a little old.
Are you somebody who paints every day? Do you feel like to paint every single day?
Yes, every day. That goes with the breathing thing. Even, you know, every day we work. I mean, I don't want to sound pretentious because I heard somebody being interviewed on a radio, and he won some big prize, and he said, I worked 16 hours a day, and now that I have my prize, I'm still working every day 16 hours a day. And I'm thinking, big deal, you know? Aren't you special? So I don't want to sound like that, but having said that, my husband and I both work every day. We go in the studio, we go out of the studio, we go in the studio, and we go out of the studio, and that's pretty much what, unless we're taking work into the galleries, and then we take a day off.
Well, we only have about a minute left. Where are people going to be able to see your work in the future, or can they now? Where can people go?
Because I'm focused on this idea of the dimension of the remembered space, the home, and the elsewhere, got from Madeline's, asked me if I wanted to have a show at Madeline's. And I said, oh, that's cool, because I'm doing these paintings of Ithaca, and it's all about, you know, this kind of sense of home and how we identify ourselves as being part of home. And also it's called We All Live by the Lake. And so I like this idea that there's this elsewhere that identifies us. So that's going to be at Madeline. And that's the work that goes to Chase in Boston. You know? So that work that's going to be at Chase and at the prisons, I'll have at Madeline's.
So they'll be able to see your work at Madeline's. Well, Tracy Zeigler, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. And anybody who has listened to this interview, you must go out and see her paintings. They are absolutely amazing.
Thank you very, very much.
Good luck with the future. Keep on painting.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.